Thank you all for coming. Can we put the slides up, please? Yes, I'm very pleased to be here. As Liana said, we have moved to Singapore because we're so keen on Singapore. We looked at many, many, many countries in the world before we decided where we wanted to live. And after thinking about the whole world, we decided to move to Singapore. So I'm extremely pleased to be here. I'm extremely pleased that the university has asked me to speak, and I'm excited that you all came. As Elim says, she was my fiance at the time, she's now my wife, Paige Parker, and I spent 3 years driving around the world. You can see we went to 116 countries. Talking about it, I'm acting. I took 2 days off, and I'm doing it. What I'm going to do now is I'm going to show you a video. I'm going to show you a 2-minute video of what it's like to drive around the world. A survey recently showed that the number one dream which people have, not everybody's number one dream, obviously, but the dream which comes out on top in the various surveys is to chuck it all, get in the car, and drive around the world. So I hope that all of you are going to get such good educations that you too are going to get yourself a car and take off around the world. It's that much fun. It starts with us in Iceland hosting each other, wondering if we're going to make it alive. Off to the Great Wall. We did get married on the trip. Here we are cutting our cake. This is our honeymoon. We ran into out there on the road. We went through 15 war zones. These guys were not very friendly at first. But if you look into the upper right-hand corner, you will see a familiar face. One of many markets we visited. One of many bad roads. This is one of the sadder times. We went to an AIDS orphanage down in South Africa. We went to see King Tut. Whenever we could, we stopped in schools, because I'm very keen on education. We always caused quite a stir, as you can imagine. Everybody wanted to have their pictures made. Myanmar, which used to be called Burma, one of many roadside stands where we ate and drank. He was in Falls down in South America. This is the beginning of my existence. This is bureaucracy, red tape, regulations. This, on the other hand, is the black market. It's a much higher class of people. When we got back to New York, to America, we kept going. We headed up to Alaska in the dead of winter. And when we got back to New York, our first stop was the World Trade Center. That had blown up while we were gone. So, let's go around the world again. Only this time, we're going to talk about some of the things I've learned in my various travels. After that, I'll take questions from you all about anything you want to talk about. The first thing we need to discuss is the rise of China. It's starting to make the press these days. But most people in the world have no clue about the depth and breadth of what's happened in China. In fact, most, whether we like it or not, I assure you there are a lot of people in the West who do not like the concept that China will be the next great country in the world. The 19th century was the century of the UK. The 20th century was the century of the US. The 21st century is going to be the century of China. Now, I know they call themselves communists in China, but let me tell you, they are among the best capitalists in the world. I know people who would tell you that they are the best capitalists in the world as we speak here in 2008. In China, they save and invest over 35% of their income. In America, for instance, we save and invest less than 2% of our income. In China, when they come to work, they don't say how many days holiday do I get. They say, how many days can I come to work? They know how we live in the West. They know how you live in Singapore. And they want to live the same way, too. They're willing to work as hard as they have to. They're willing to save and invest. I assure you there will be setbacks. America had some horrible setbacks as we rose to power and glory. China will too. You're going to see more real estate speculators or real estate developers going bankrupt this year in China and next for that matter. They're already having some setbacks in their stock market as the government tried to cool things off. But when you see setbacks in China, don't think it's the end of the story. Don't think that that's it. This was a flash in the pan. Pick up the phone and try to get more involved in China, one way or the other. When I speak to people in most parts of the world, not everywhere, I tell them that the best advice of any kind which I can give you, is to teach your children and your grandchildren Mandarin. It's going to be the most important language in their lifetime. And Liam said, and I showed you guys a picture of my little girl. My little girl speaks perfect Mandarin. My little girl, when she was born, we got her a Chinese governess who lives with us. And I said to her, you only speak Mandarin, this little girl. I want her to grow up with two native languages. I want her to speak Mandarin like a native, and I want her to speak English, which I'm responsible for. I want her to speak English and Chinese like a native, and it's worked. One of the reasons we moved to Singapore was to make sure that both of these little girls grow up speaking Mandarin. Of course, one problem in Singapore is some people speak bad English and bad Mandarin. I think you know. Some people speak good English, and some people speak good Mandarin, too. So much as they don't. In any case, both of these little girls, I think the best skills which I can give to two children born in 2003 and 2008 is to be perfectly fluent in Chinese and in things Asian. So we are not just, again, not just talking about it. We packed up and sold our house in New York and have come to Singapore to live. Our little girls, thank you, our little girls are going to go to school here for, you know, until they're grown-ups. Another thing we need to understand concerns the state of the U.S. dollar. The United States dollar is and has been the world's reserve currency. That's in the process of changing. As recently as 1987, the United States was a creditor nation. That's only 21 years ago. But in the last 21 years, America's foreign debts now exceed 13 trillion U.S. dollars. That's trillion with a T. So America is in terrible, terrible debt as far as the rest of the world is concerned. Being $13 trillion in debt, U.S. dollars in debt, is pretty terrifying to me anyway, as an American citizen. But I will tell you what is even more worrisome to me is the fact that the United States foreign debt increases at the rate of $1 trillion U.S. dollars every 15 months. Every 15 months, the United States goes deeper into debt by another trillion U.S. dollars. You can do the arithmetic. You all have fine universities in Singapore. Every 15 months, it's another trillion dollars in debt. Many of America's enemies are starting to figure out ways to try to exploit this potential weakness in America. But also, many of our friends are starting to say, hey, what's going on with these people? Maybe America's out of control. And I will tell you, America is out of control. To the extent that anybody is aware of this problem in the United States, in the government especially, it is their policy to continue to debase the currency. They want to drive down the value of the dollar because they think it will make America more competitive. I will tell you, in fact, the head of the central bank in America is on official record, is saying if he has to get into a helicopter and fly around the world and drop out dollar bills, in order to drive down the value of the U.S. dollar, he will do so. Now, I can tell you this is a terrible policy. It has never worked in history. Many countries have tried debasing the currency as a way to become more competitive. It has never worked in the long term. It has never worked in the medium term. Sometimes it works in the short term, but not always. But it doesn't matter what I think, and it doesn't matter what any of you think, because as the same head of the central bank said in another official statement, these are official statements, you have to understand 21st century central bank. We control the printing presses, and we will run those printing presses as fast as we have to. Now, you have to take this man at his word. He's an academic who spent his whole career studying the printing of money, and now we've given him the printing presses. He doesn't understand economics, he doesn't understand markets, he doesn't understand the foreign currency, but he understands printing money. He is already printing money at a rapid rate, and as things continue to get worse, and they will, he's going to print money until we run out of trees. And he is very, very intent, and that's all he knows is a way to save the world, but it's going to make the world the worst place. You've got to understand this. Some of you, well, I guess most of you were not around when this was still a British colony, but some of you remember or have read about when the pound sterling was the world's reserve currency. That status changed, and the pound sterling is no longer the world's reserve currency. It gave way to the dollar. But during that transition, a lot of people lost fortunes because they did not understand what was going on. Other people made fortunes. The people who understood what was happening capitalized on it and made fortunes for themselves, their families, their companies. You've got to understand this change is taking place. It is very historic. It doesn't happen every generation. It happens every 5 or 6 generations. And it's happening again. You've got to figure out a way to protect yourselves. You know, I showed you pictures of my little girls. My little girls are American citizens. My little girls have passports. My little girls have bank accounts. But my little girls do not have American bank accounts. My little girls have Singapore bank accounts. They know what's happening to the value of the U.S. dollar. They know that the U.S. dollar is being debased. They know that in their lifetime, the U.S. dollar is going to be problematic at best. So, and they got to take care of me someday too. So let's hope my little girls are getting it right. More about the markets. You know, in the 1980s and 90s, we had a big bull market in bonds. Bonds throughout most parts of the world were in a bull market, and they went up all the time for 25 years or so. In my view, that has come to an end. In my view, the bond market has made a top, a big long top, and bonds will be going down for years to come. In fact, I sold more bonds short on Friday, and I presume I'll sell more bonds short today, long-term U.S. government bonds. So bonds are not a place to be. If you own bonds, long-term bonds, I would urge you to go home and sell them. Unless there's special situations or short, very short-term bonds. And if any of you aspire to being a bond portfolio manager, get another job. If any of you are bond portfolio managers, you definitely need to get another job. Because the bond market is open. Even if I'm wrong, you're not going to make any money at bonds, long-term bonds. Bonds, long-term bonds yield anywhere from 2 to 5%, depending on the country we're talking about. So that's not a place to make money. Stocks in the West have been in stocks in the West were also in a big bull market in the 80s and 90s, as you know, but in my view, that bull market is finished. Bonds at best are going to be in a big trading range like this. It has been for 8 years. It's going to be the same for another at least 8 years. If you're good at buying the stocks here and selling them here 4 or 5 years later, you can make a lot of money. But most people are not very good at that. Most people are not good at market timing. Most people need to have a secular bull market, a market where things are essentially going up all the time. And that's not going to be the case with stocks, at least in my view. Stocks in the West are still very expensive on any of the classic valuation methods. I'm sure you all have learned about dividend yields and price earnings ratios and book values. Stocks in the West, even after the recent declines, are still expensive on a historic basis. We have a secular bull market now. It's in raw materials or natural resources or commodities, you can call it what you will. Unfortunately, when I try to tell people, most people about commodities, most people still cannot spell commodities. Most people don't have a clue what I'm talking about. Most people think you get your coffee at Starbucks. They don't understand that this is a place where you can make a lot of money if you do your homework and you get it right. I would remind you, however, that 30 years ago, most people couldn't spell mutual funds. In fact, if you had gone to Paris or Rome or Madrid as recently as 1980 and said, take me to the stock exchange, people would have said to you, what is a stock exchange? I was there, I know they were doing this. People did not even know what a stock exchange was as recently as 28 years ago. And the same was true in Singapore. People just didn't know in most parts of the world about stock markets. And we had this huge bull market in the 80s and 90s, and everybody learned about stock. stock exchanges and mutual funds and stocks. You know the rest of that story. Well, that's what commodities are now. I suspect in this room full of intelligent and sophisticated people, none of you have ever bought a commodity, or very few have ever bought a commodity in your life, if any at all. In the world right now, there are over 70,000 mutual funds for the public to invest in stocks and bonds. There are fewer than 100 for the public to invest in commodities. It's an uninvested, unknown, undiscovered asset class, even though the commodity markets are the second largest markets in the world, second after foreign currency markets. And yet nobody's invested in them for the most part, not yet anyway. Someday there are going to be hundreds, thousands of mutual funds for the public to invest in commodities. Someday everybody's going to be talking about commodities. Your schools, I suspect in your schools, there's not a single course in commodities right now. Although your courses, your schools teach you a lot about stocks, bonds, currencies, derivatives, all sorts of wonderful, exciting things, but you cannot take a course in commodities. That's how unknown it is, and that's why there are great opportunities there. When I tell people all of this, I say, look, this has been going on for many centuries. We have long periods of rising commodity prices, followed by long periods of declining commodity prices, and then they rise again for long periods. Look, I'm not terribly smart. You can go look it up. That's all I did. I just went and looked this up. You can look it up too. And now one of you is probably going to say, well, how long do these periods last? On average, it's about 18 years. I went and looked it up. I found, you know, the short one was 15 years, the longest was 23 years. I have no idea how long this bull market will last. We're about 8 or 9 years into it now. But if history is any guide, you know, by around 2020, this bull market will come to an end. Maybe in 2020, I'll be invited back. And I will say, it's time to sell your commodities. And you're all going to shout and scream and throw things at me and say, you old fool, what are you talking about? Commodities always go up. Your schools will have special degrees just in commodities by 2020. And I'll say, make a mistake, go get an MBA. You know, all of you are getting MBAs now making mistakes. If you ask me, you're learning about agriculture or mining or something more useful. So on average, it's about 18 or 20 years that these periods have lasted in the past. Now somebody's going to say, because you're all diligent students, somebody's going to say, how long do these periods last after the 18 years? Then you're going to say, well, what causes them? What causes these long cycles? And I'm going to say again, it's very simple. It's supply and demand. In the 1980s and 1990s, when people were calling you and saying, buy stocks, buy mutual funds, nobody called up and said, let's invest in a sugar plantation. Nobody called up and said, let's invest in a lead mine. And that's because commodities were in a bear market. That's a lot of history. People have not invested in productive capacity during a bear market. Maybe they should have, but they never have. Probably never will. There's been one lead mine opened in the world in the past 25 years. The last lead smelter built in the United States was built in 1969. Think about all the great oil fields in the world. They were all discovered more than 40 years ago. Most of the people in this room were not even born the last time a gigantic elephant oil field was discovered. The Alaskan oil fields are in decline. The Mexican oil fields are in decline. The North Sea is in decline. The UK has been exporting oil for 26, 27 years. Within the decade, the UK will be a net importer of oil again. Our neighbors in Malaysia have been a great oil exporting nation for decades. Within the decade, Malaysia is going to be importing oil again. Indonesia is a member of OPEC. OPEC stands for the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. They're getting thrown out of OPEC, because now they're a net importer of oil after decades. 10 years ago, China exported oil. Now they're the second largest importer of oil in the world. Oil fields deplete, mines deplete. That's the way the world has always worked. Nothing magic about it. That's the supply side. The demand side, well, you're part of the demand side. All of Asia, 3 billion people in Asia. Asia's been growing for 25 years. Most people in the world have been growing for 25 years. So for 25 years, we've had supply going down, demand going up. Well, that's called a bull market. It's a very simple concept. That's what's taking place in the world. And by the way, if you do go back and do your homework, you'll also find that in developed markets anyway, whenever we've had a bull market in stocks, commodities have done bad. Conversely, when commodities have done well, such as the 70s, stocks have done bad. I have a theory as to why the way the world works this way. I mean, who cares about the theory? Facts are, it's always worked this way. Probably always will work this way if my theories have correct. During this period of time, well, before I set out on my last trip, I came to the conclusion that the bear market in commodities was coming to an end. So on August 1st, 1998, I started a commodities index fund. You can see, in that period of time, it's up 317%, while stocks have done nothing. Stocks are up 23%. Commodities have done, what's that, 14, 1500% better than stocks in this period of time. Proving it once again, we should not trifle with history. Same thing is happening again. Commodities are going through the roof. Stocks are doing nothing. By the way, there will be setbacks along the way. You can see here in 2001, there was a big setback with commodities. You can also see that stocks went down further. First of all, stocks started going down first, went down further, and stayed down further. By the way, 2001, that was caused by 9/11. That was the reason for that decline. We seem to be having another decline now. Again, you can see stocks started going down long before commodities did, and will probably go down further and stay down further. This is in the process of happening. You know, those of you who understand markets know that when in 2020, if I'm invited back, by then, commodities will be going, you know, through the roof, be skyrocketing. Everybody will be talking about commodities. My little girls have never owned a stock. My little girls have never owned a bond. My little girls only own commodities. My little girl is very happy only owning commodities, I might point out. This next slide is a sort of Barclays trading room, which is all indexes in the world. It just shows you that commodities have been the best place to be of all asset classes everywhere. This next slide is a correlation matrix. It basically shows you that if you diversify your portfolio, you should have commodities there because commodities are not going to do what your other assets are going to do. It's a perfect anchor for a diversified portfolio because they're going to go their separate way. By the way, I do not diversify. Diversification is something that stockbrokers came up with to save themselves, but nobody's going to get rich diversifying. But if you do diversify or think you should, this is the perfect anchor. I'm going to give you a slight lesson in a case study in oil, which is the most important commodity. I'll give you the case study so to show you what's happening. But what I'm about to say about oil applies to nearly all commodities. You all probably know that Aramco, which is the Saudi Arabian oil company, used to be owned by BP and Shell, Exxon, people like that. In the 1970s, the Saudis nationalized Aramco, threw the rest out, but the last Westerners to leave did an audit. And they came to the conclusion that Saudi Arabia had 245 billion barrels of oil. Now, we didn't hear a word about the Saudi oil fields for a decade, and then in 1988, Saudi Arabia announced we have 260 billion barrels of oil. They didn't say how they knew or where they were. They didn't say anything. They said we had 260 billion barrels of oil. Every year since 1988, Saudi Arabia has announced we have 260 billion barrels of oil. It was astonishing. It never goes, well, last year they said they had 261 billion barrels of oil. And by the way, they have produced in that period of time 67 billion barrels of oil. Now, when nuts like me go to the Saudis and say, how could this possibly be? How could you always have 260 billion barrels of oil year after year after year? You know what the Saudis say? They say, you either believe us or you don't. And that's the end of the conversation. I'm not a geologist, and even if I were, I've never been to the Saudi oil field. They don't let people go to the Saudi oil field. But I know that every oil country in the world has declining reserves, except Saudi Arabia, of course. I know that every oil company in the world, nearly every oil company in the world, has declining reserves. So I know that unless somebody discovers a lot of oil very quickly in very accessible areas, the surprise is going to be how high the price of oil stays and how high it eventually goes. That's the supply side. Let's look at the demand side. The Chinese use 1/10 as much oil per capita as their neighbors, the Koreans, do. The Indians use 1/20 as much per capita as their neighbors in Japan do. Forget America. America's far off the scale. Doesn't so far off the scale, doesn't really matter. But let's just suppose that the Indians double their consumption of oil. They'll still be using 1/10 as much per capita as their neighbors do. And I assure you, the Indians are going to double their per capita consumption. I assure you, the Chinese are going to double their consumption, and it'll still be nothing on a per capita basis. But there are 2.3 billion people in India and China. And as they increase their consumption of energy, it's going to put terrible pressure on the prices and the supplies of all commodities. Because as you can see, we're at a period when the supplies are constrained, supplies are under duress. So I would urge you all to take a few lessons from my little girls. Learn Mandarin. Good Mandarin. Not Singapore Mandarin, good Mandarin. Learn about the US dollar. Don't put your money in US dollars. You've got a way to diversify away from the US dollar. And learn about commodities. The greatest opportunities in your lifetimes, all of you who are students and getting out of school soon, are going to be the bull market. The only bull market I know is in commodities right now. There are very few people who are interested in commodities, very few people who know anything about them. There's a huge glut of stockbrokers, investment bankers, stock people. There's a huge shortage of people who know about commodities. So if I were 22 years old or 24 years old, coming out of university, and I were interested in finance, only if I were interested in finance, I would head straight down to the commodity markets and start trying to get myself a job, no matter how low, because that's where the bull market's going to be for the next 10, 15 years. So on that happy note, what I think I'll do is I will take questions. I will take questions about anything. We can talk about money in the spot. I've been to some good ones. I've been to some bad ones. I've actually had a good honeymoon and a bad honeymoon, as a matter of fact. We can talk about the best beer in the world. We can talk about how to make money. We can talk about anything you want to talk about. Just raise your hand and we'll, yes. You get the first question, you introduce me. How what? Question was, why would we, why did we choose Singapore as a place to live in Asia? Well, we looked at Europe, we looked at a lot of places. You know, page 9, I went around the world, I've been around the world twice. To me, it's very important to live, to both of us, it's very important to live in a Chinese-speaking city. And we looked at the various cities in China, and unfortunately, the cities in China have such horrible pollution that we couldn't bring ourselves to live there. I didn't want to breathe it. I certainly didn't want my family breathing that horrible air. And in Singapore, everything works. You've got the best education in the world. You've got the best medical care in the world. Everything works in Singapore. So it's a perfect place as far as I'm concerned. And we did look at other countries, but we decided in the end that Singapore was the best. Singapore has been the most successful country in the world for the past 40 years. Japan was the most successful for the past 50 years. Singapore for the past 40 years. I guess China's most successful for the past 30 years. But I mean, it's a terrific place. It's got a, even if the rest of the world goes broke, Singapore is going to be the last one to go broke. We're all living at the right place at the right time. By the way, my babies and I all have PR status in Singapore, permanent resident status, and so we're very keen and we're committed. We're here. Did I say something wrong or not? I prefer to stay.
I would stay with you.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am Leonard Young. Is this my call?
Can you hear him in the back?
I'm Leonard Young. I'm the dean of NUS Business School. I'm the new kid in the block. I'm really happy that NUS is collaborating with ACE and NDU in featuring this speech, this wonderful presentation by Mr. Jim Rogers. There's one thing about Mr. Rogers. I actually met him, I think the first time it was last year. No, I was at 207 in China Institute in New York City. He think fast, act fast, with determination, and that's why he's successful. Actually, may I reveal the thing that you also told me? That you are one of your record that has not been revealed is that you are the fastest man on a Harley Royal Regatta for the fastest time ever. So you put your mind and your physical body all in the same action, fast with determination and act properly. Thank you. I actually kind of regret that I follow your step, but too late. You are a year ahead of me, and now I suffer from the financial crisis. And I'm working for anywhere for free. Because I've lost the money.
Oh.
So let me ask you this question. I was thinking about, you give us the advice about, by the way, I'm supposed to be here to moderate the Q&A, but I cannot resist the temptation to introduce myself and also to ask another question. I mean to ask a question about how Singapore can leverage the two important factors you mentioned, the raw material and commodities, and also the China factor. But Elaine had already asked the question, so let me ask you another question. We have a room full of youngsters here, and this is deep economic winter. And I'm pretty sad, I guess we all are sad. But can you tell us, cheer us up, what is the silver lining in this?
Well, there are always opportunities, even in the worst of times. In the 1930s, in the Great Depression, there were a lot of people who made fortunes. Lots of people who made fortunes. A lot of people lost fortunes, needless to say. But the people who looked for and found opportunities made a lot of money. What I would suggest to all of you is that you figure out what you yourself love most of all, what is your passion, and pursue it. Don't listen to me, don't listen to your professors, don't listen to your families, don't listen to your mothers and daddies. And if you really love something, then you should pursue it. Let's say you love gardening. Now, if you get out of this university and say to the dean, I'm going to be a gardener. He's going to do his best to talk you out of it. He doesn't want his graduates going out of here being gardeners. He wants them to go to Wall Street. He wants them, to make fortunes. But you say to him, no, I really love gardening. Your parents are going to say the same thing. But that's your passion, you pursue it. And I promise you, someday, you're probably going to be the gardener at Astana. Someday, you're going to have a chain of garden shops all over Asia. Someday, it's going to be listed on the New York Stock Exchange. And someday, you're going to name a school after you. They're going to be so proud that you went out of here and became a gardener. So follow your passions. If you love cooking, then become a cook. And someday, maybe you'll have a big chain of restaurants. There'll be this little London Exchange. Who knows what will happen? Or the Shanghai Exchange. So follow your own passion, especially these days, because that's the only job you're going to get these days. If you don't really just love finance or Wall Street with a passion, don't go there, because it's going to be very difficult there. People in the 1970s, very few people went to Wall Street because it was a nightmare. The few people who did go got thrown out of Wall Street, unless it was their passion. I went there in 1968, it was the exact top of the market. It was a disaster for the next 10 or 15 years on Wall Street, but I happened to love it. I didn't know it was bad time. I didn't care it was bad time, because I loved it so much. So figure out what you yourself love the most, and then pursue that. That's the only way you're going to be successful in the coming period of time.
Jim, you're amazing. In the past 45 minutes, you have given us the fundamentals of economic demand and supply. And now you're giving us another aspect of it, the psychology. Find the fire in your belly and light it up, and that's the way to go. Thank you for that. And for that, let me ask people to ask questions. we are being asked to light up the fire in our belly and move forward. And let's light up the room with questions. There must be more wonderful insights and wisdoms that we can get from Mr. Rogers. Any tickers? We have, my understanding is that we have four different mics in four different corners. For those who raise their hands, please line up at the mic, okay? Let's make sure there is not more than two or three in each mic, at each mic. This gentleman, please.
NU, I got this question. It has been reported that oil sands like oil shells are becoming a substitute for oil. And if extracting technologies are improved and become more economical, will it become a substitute for oil and become a oil fuel, another oil fuel? We have seen from the news that even the KG, Warren Buffett and Bill Gates has went to Canada to take a look at these aspects. What's your understanding about these oil sands?
Right. For those of you who don't know, out here in Alberta, which is a province of Canada, there are gigantic deposits of oil sands. That's what that means is the oil is permeated with sand. And if you mine it, literally mine it, you have to take the sand to a factory and you separate the sand from the oil and you have oil for it. It is a expensive, very expensive way to produce oil, but there's a lot of oil there. I've been up there too and I actually own shares in some of the oil sand companies. And according to the estimate, there are gigantic quantities of oil up there in the oil sands and people are spending a lot of money getting oil from the oil sands. The problem is it's expensive and it takes a long time. Huge amounts of money. Even the biggest bulls on the oil sands say that by 2013 we will be getting another 1 million barrels of oil a day from the oil sands. The world uses 86 million barrels of oil a day. We'll be happy to have an extra 1 million barrels of oil a day out of the oil sands in 5 years. Because remember, all the other oil fields in the world are in decline. But 1 million barrels a day is not going to offset the fact that every other oil field in the world is in decline. The wildest bull say that by 2018 we'll be getting an extra 2 million barrels of oil a day from the oil sands. Let's hope we do. But 2 million extra oil, 2 million extra barrels a day by 2018 is not going to solve the world's problem. I do own the shares, it is wonderful what's going on up there, but it's not enough to solve the problems.
I actually lived in Alberta before, and I regret I sold my house. I know the oil sand there.
Should have stayed in Alberta.
It's a bit too cold, it's better to be close to the equator.
I concur with that, I'm here too. I guess.
Next, please.
Hi, my name is Ben, and I'm an investor. I'd like to actually find out, because you mentioned that US dollars is really attractiveness and will be dethroned soon. And you also mentioned that China will be the next D. Do you think the yuan will take over the US dollar in a very short time, in the near future? That's the first question. Second question is, I'm more aware that actually Chinese government have 1/3 of their foreign reserve in the US treasury bond. And what's your opinion of that, having the financial meltdown on that?
Well, I'll ask the second question first. I said earlier, I'm so short of the United States government bonds. I sold them short as recently as Friday, and I will short more today, I hope. So I think they're doing a very foolish thing. I'm happy they're doing it because they're holding the bonds up so I can sell them. You know, they're holding them up at a higher price. But in my view, the last bubble, the moment, the last bubble left is the United States government bond market. It's too high, it's been propped up artificially, and it's a bubble which is going to pop and it's going to collapse. Maybe I'm going to collapse if I'm wrong, but I am selling the bond short. Which currency will replace the dollar? Well, I don't know. It cannot be the renminbi right now. I own the renminbi, and I buy the renminbi whenever I can, but the renminbi cannot replace the US dollar now. I mean, the renminbi is a blocked currency, so it's absurd to even talk about that. But if you look around the world, I mean, I guess if the dollar collapsed today, you would probably have people rushing to the euro because it's the only viable, or seemingly only viable
alternative. However, I don't expect the euro to survive 10, 15 years from now. So I don't think the euro replaced the dollar. But renminbi is the only thing I can see on the long-term horizon. The U.S. dollar is having a big rally right now. The world is in a phase of forced liquidation. In other words, everybody has to reverse their positions no matter what they are. You've had periods like this periodically in history where people just have to reverse their position. They don't have any choice. There are huge short positions in the U.S. dollar, and so everybody's being forced to cover their shorts. That's why the dollar is going up. My plan is to use this rally of the U.S. dollar sometimes in the next few days, weeks, or months, or year. I plan to get rid of the rest of my U.S. dollars. I hope that by this time next year I own no U.S. dollars. This big rally is short covering because of the forced liquidation, but it should give me a chance to get out. And if the Chinese will continue to hold up the U.S. government bond market, give me a chance to sell more at higher prices.
I cannot resist the temptation. Do you foresee the world developing into a free currency arrangement with the U.S. dollar in America, euro in Europe, and maybe the yuan in Asia?
It could happen. It would not be good for the world because what the world needs is free and open markets, open trade. You know, if you start having trading enclaves, and that's never been good. Whenever some of you know that in the 1930s, the world tried to close itself off, and all countries tried to, the expression in those days was, beggar my neighbor. In other words, we'll take care of ourselves, we don't care about our neighbors. And that led to the Great Depression, and then, of course, led to the Second World War. And so after the Second World War, people say, we're never going to let that happen again. They started with the World Trade Organization, it was called GATT then, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. They were going to open up the world to free trade. And they continue to do that. The world's had a very prosperous 50 or 60 years. If the world starts closing off again, you better become a farmer. That's what you better do. Because the farmers are going to be the only ones that are making any money. In the past 10 years, there's been a lot of 29-year-olds on Wall Street riding around in Maseratis. That's about to change. And in my view, you're going to have those guys are all going to be learning to drive cabs. The smart ones will learn to drive tractors, and then maybe they'll go and get jobs in the 29-year-old cotton farmers. Because the 29-year-old farmers are going to be the ones having the Maseratis in the next 10 years. Or the miners or the lumberjacks. You know, it's not. The world is changing. It's changing right in front of our eyes. And it's going to be very dramatic.
I'm going to go around and see if this line of conduct arbitrage here. So let me start with that line, that question over there, and then I'll go back up and then back down.
Hello, Jeff. My name is Manoj, and I'm ex-MBA, NUS MBA alumni. And the question which I'm going to ask is somebody of your caliber can answer that question. First of all, thank you very much for your book on how commodities, because that gave me an idea about the commodities sector, you know. And I got into it about 3 years back. But I wasn't directly into the commodities, but something which commodity uses, for example, the potash, Monsanto, and CFO beans, and agribusiness and all. That's been a wonderful time. Now, the question we have is related to the liquidity which is being pumped in the full strength. You see the markets colliding, the financial structure being, the financial orientation being restructured, and then later on you also see the geopolitical things coming into play. Now, based on your around the world travel, and based on your experiences in the commodities, the bonds, and the market, what do you see the trends coming up, probably say, after this Mises scheme? Not necessarily only on the Wall Street, but for the general public. What kind of industries will emerge from this collision? What kind of trends will emerge that people can apply up?
Well, the trends are Asia. I move here because this is, I want my children to grow up in Asia. The West is finished, America. You know, America is the largest debtor nation the world has ever seen. America is terribly overextended militarily, geopolitically, financially. America is terribly overextended in every way. And Asia is not. The largest creditor nations in the world now are all in Asia. China, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, Singapore. These are all the largest creditors, Russia, which is in Asia, Saudi Arabia. These are all Asian countries, and that's where the money is now. It's not in America, it's not in the West. And the world is changing, so I would urge you to move to Asia if you haven't already. So that's the major trend I see. One of the things that history shows is that when you find a period of forced liquidation like now, the things which come out on the other side, or that come out the best, and where you make the most money, are the things where the fundamentals are unimpaired. Morgan Stanley is a major American investment bank. Its fundamentals are impaired, as we speak. The only industries I can see that are unimpaired, where the fundamentals are impaired, are commodities, especially agriculture. So when I said that the 29-year-old cotton farmers are going to be driving Maseratis, I was not joking. That is the best place that I can see in the next 10 or 15 years for people to make money. Those fundamentals are unimpaired, the supply-demand situation is still in favor of the producer, the current situation is making it even worse, nobody can get money to even expand production for agricultural products, you certainly cannot get money to open a mine now, nobody will need your money for anything, so this means that the supplies of everything are going to continue to be under stress. Now demand, of course, is being affected by all of this, and demand will slow down, but the supply is slowing down faster. In the 1970s, we had horrible worldwide economic conditions. The price of oil went up 10 times. The price of sugar went up 47 times. The price of silver went up about 40 times. While the world was in trouble economically, the supply was going down even faster. So you can remember, prices are set by supply and demand. So if supply goes down faster than demand, you can still have a big bull market. So those are the major trends I see. I also see what I call some airlines recently. I think the airlines will come out of this much better than they went into it. I mentioned China, I mentioned Asia, I mentioned commodities. Water treatment, if you can figure out a way, if you're passionate about water and water treatment, there are going to be huge fortunes made in water treatment. And northern China has a... Anybody seen northern China recently? Northern China has a horrible water problem. In fact, if China doesn't do something about its water problem, it will not be a China story. I've been around the world twice, and so many cities and societies and countries have just disappeared because the water disappeared. You can survive war and famine and plague and everything else, but you cannot, in civil war, but you cannot survive if the water is gone. Northern India also has a horrible water problem, even worse than China's. So water is going to be one of the great, great growth industries of the next 10, 20, 30 years. Singapore is well situated. You know, 50 years ago, Singapore was a swamp. And Singapore has done a brilliant job of dealing with the water situation, continues to do so, has a lot of technology here, developed over those past 50 years of having water problems. Another area that where I see huge opportunities in the next 50 years is tourism, Asian Chinese tourism especially. For 300 years, the Chinese have basically not been able to travel. Now they can get passports, now they can get a currency to take out of the country. The government encourages them to travel in fact. So there's going to be a huge pent-up demand for travel from the Chinese. There are 300 billion of them. I can remember back in the 80s when all of a sudden we started seeing a lot of Japanese in New York over on Madison Avenue. And everybody said, well, where did the Japanese come from? You know, but the Japanese suddenly started traveling after 50 years of not being able to travel. There are only 125 million Japanese. There are 100 million Chinese, 12 times as many, and now they're all going to travel. So Chinese tourism or travel, both internally and internationally, are both going to have a huge positive future. Those are some of the things. Girls have a great future. There's a huge shift. That's why I had girls.
But let me explain. In Asia right now, there's a huge shortage of women developing. In Korea right now, for every 121-year-old girls or women, there are 120 21-year-old boys in Korea. The women in parts of India right now, they cannot find wives. There's just no women, no girls. In China last year, there were 119 boys born for every 100 girls. The whole world is changing, especially in Asia, because there's a gigantic shortage of women developing. You know, women in Asia have been down here, but the process is now changing. And when those little girls get to be big girls, they can have anybody they want. You better be nice to them, because if you're not, you're gone. You know, they can have any employer, any husband, any boyfriend that they want. Divorce laws are in a boom in Asia. You can become a divorce lawyer. You can figure out ways to. This is a major trend, which is going to be changing. I would also point out to you all that 1,000 years ago in Europe, the same thing happened. A huge shortage of females developed for a lot of the same reasons. And in those days, the boys' family paid a dowry. The boys' family paid the dowry because there was a shortage of females. And women rose to the top. They ran a lot of city states. They ran a lot of companies. They did a great job for a couple hundred years, and the demographics changed again. So this shortage of women and the changing status of women in Asia is going to change everything you know. And as I said, you better be nice to them, because if you're not, and that's why I had girls, by the way.
Luckily, I also have a girl. I'm going to be very nice to my 16-year-old and ask her to hold on to her option banner. Upstairs, please.
My name is Victor. I'm a small businessman. I've never been to universities classes. I just started a jatropha farm in Malaysia, planting a jatropha tree. Jim, can you give us your thought for the next 10 years on the biofuel business?
Yes, I can. And by the way, the fact that you didn't go to university is not terribly relevant. I went to a couple of very fancy universities and I had a lot of fun at those universities, but I can tell you some of my friends who went to those fancy universities would have been better off not going to university. And in fact, UVM, where's UVM? UVM here, UVM didn't even finish high school, secondary school. She's the smartest woman that I know in Singapore. Terribly successful. So don't let that hold you back. Biofuels have a great future because politicians love biofuels. They can pay off their farmer voters. They can pay off their friends who build the biofuel factories, and they can. And the politicians can go around saying, "We're getting our fuel from loyal farmers of this nation, whether it's Brazil or Malaysia or Indonesia or America." So politicians love it. Biofuels, unfortunately, are not good for the world. They cause many problems. The studies all show that a liter of biofuel, it takes almost as much energy to produce a liter of biofuel as a liter of biofuel produces. So essentially, it's not helping our energy problems at all. It takes huge amounts of water. It's driving up the price of food if we burn our agriculture in our fuel tanks. So it's not good for the world. Doesn't matter what I think, doesn't matter what the studies show, because the politicians love, love, love bioenergy and will subsidize it as long as they have to. So if you're in the biofuel business, you're probably going to make a lot of money and so the world someday may catch on, but someday is a long time from now.
My name is Grace Chia. I like gold. So I guess my question is that what form of gold should one invest in, fiscal, in accounts or whatever it is, and how do you see the gold will go up to what price and over what duration of time? Thank you.
I like gold too. And make me an offer. My little girls like gold. Whenever I go to China, I buy them gold pandas because they like pandas and I like gold. So we have a special deal.
I own gold, my own girls own gold, we own gold futures, and we own gold coins as well. Everybody, if you know a good gold mine, maybe you want to buy shares in the gold mine, as long as you know what you're doing. There are various ways to own gold. You can buy gold ETFs. An ETF is an exchange traded fund, which is a way you can buy gold now on a stock exchange. In Switzerland, there's actually an ETF where you can actually you buy the paper, but if you ever wanted to go to the bank and say, give me the gold, they'll give you the gold. There are a couple of those kind of things now that you can do. You really have to decide yourself which way you want to do it. My old girls and I own a lot of gold coins we have at home. In case the world comes to an end, we'll have some gold. Go ahead and, I don't know, roll around in our gold, but nothing else. But if you go down to the shop and buy some bread, who knows what's going to happen. But we own gold in various ways. I think I'm going to make more money in agriculture for a while than I am in gold. Gold has been going up, and agriculture has been going down recently, so I think I have probably better opportunities elsewhere, but I own it. If it goes down, I'm going to buy more. If it goes up, I'll buy more. So don't sell your gold.
Would it be a good idea to have focus on concentration of, say, for long term, say 80% on gold and 20% for other things for long term?
Well, please, I mean, I don't know you, I just met you, as you know. So it's hard for me to say, well, you should have 18% or 17.5% in gold. You'll have to make that decision yourself, but I certainly will.
Or you can ask the question for Pete.
Grace, I don't know. It's just that the world is evolving every day. So I don't know. If the world comes to an end tomorrow, I'll probably buy more at higher prices. If the world collapses tomorrow, I'll probably buy more at lower prices. So I don't really know.
May I turn up there on the second floor?
My name is Luis. I'm originally from Mexico. I came to Singapore 3 years ago for the same reasons as you mentioned. I'm into Asia looking for new opportunities. After traveling around Asia as well for a while and looking at some developed countries like Japan, Korea, Singapore, and touching on the energy and sources of energy that you spoke about, I saw that these developed countries have a very high consumption of energy. And the person downstairs as well mentioned about biofuels. But what is your point of view on the other alternative sources of energy, like solar energy, wind energy? Would you say that they will be the new commodities as well in the next 20 years?
So, Lewis, first I need to do what I'm saying, leaving Mexico to come to Asia, leaving anywhere to come to Asia is wise, especially Mexico. As you know, Mexico's oil production. For those of you who don't know, the Mexican government gets 40% of its income from oil production. Their oil production is collapsing. It's going down very, very rapidly in Mexico. And Mexico has one of the youngest populations in the world, demographically. There are 100 million Mexicans. A very young population, and if the oil does production does collapse as fast as it might, you're probably going to have a lot of turmoil in Mexico in the next 10 or 20 years as the income collapses. You've got a lot of very, very young people. Young people are always agitated about something anyway, and especially if they don't have any money, they're going to be very agitated. So it's going to be a complicated situation. So you did a smart thing to come here. As far as alternate energy, yes, yes, yes. You know, wind power is now becoming competitive with oil at $75, $80 a barrel. Wind power is competitive, and even if it weren't, the politicians love it again. Solar power is not competitive with oil at $75 or $80 a barrel, but it's becoming more competitive all the time. Again, all of these alternate energy sources have wonderful futures as far as I'm concerned, because the price of oil is going to stay high and go higher. Someday we're all going to look out around Singapore and we're going to see solar panels everywhere. We might even see windmills in some parts of Singapore someday, all over the world. But none of these things can solve the world's problems right now. If the world decided today to all convert to windmills,
You can't get a linear one. I mean, it's just not enough capacity. It's going to take decades for the world to convert to wind power, solar power, or some of the other alternative ways of doing it. This is one reason they have great meters. I haven't seen, I don't think I've ever seen a solar panel in Singapore. It needs to be an ideal place. So someday, yes, it's all going to be great.
I have to look at the watch, and so we have to speed up this process. So, this lady here, please.
Well, my only Australian dollar, what I've been buying recently. The Australian dollar is getting pounded right now because the carriage rate was unwinding. And you know what the carriage rate is? The carry trade in Japan is unwinding, and people are selling their Australian. What happened was a lot of people borrowed, for those of you who don't know, people could borrow money in Japan at very, very, very low rates of interest. They would convert the yen into Australian dollars and invest in Australia because they could get higher returns in Australia, New Zealand, other places. The carry trade is unwinding. I've been buying the yen for the past several months because I thought I could see the carry trade unwinding, and then I knew it would pound the Australian dollar. I didn't sell my Australian dollars or my New Zealand dollars because they're both very sound currencies. As far as I'm concerned, they're both natural resource-based currencies, so I'm just holding my Australian dollars and New Zealand dollars through the collapse. The carry trade will eventually be completely on the mound, and then those currencies, I hope, will have recoveries. Doesn't mean they cannot go down more in the meantime, because the carry trade was huge, is huge, but it's unwinding at a very rapid rate right now. That's not much consolation to you if you have to sit through this, because it could go on a while longer. But I'm not selling now, it's ready.
Give me a call.
Okay, hey, I'll give you my card.
We're in a situation that we have to face demand and supply too. We have only about roughly 5 minutes left, so I'm going to take two more questions. And we have to wrap this up. For those who have, I noticed that end has not been given a chance yet. I'll give you the first opportunity, and then over here. Please.
All right. My name is Mike, and I went to high school in Philadelphia, and went to university in the Netherlands. Now I'm here for exchange at NTU. Well, after visiting a few places, not as many as you, of course, I see that this is one of the most restrictive places I've been so far. Well, let's face it has a one party, and I cannot eat and drink on the MRT, and this is my first impression. Well, you made a very strong commitment to Singapore, and you're making a very even stronger commitment to China. Is this the future you see? Is this how you see the future, especially for developing politically too?
Well, between Philadelphia, the Netherlands, and Singapore, I assure you I'd rather be in Singapore, even though the Netherlands is a wonderful, wonderful place. And the fact that you cannot eat and drink on the MRT, if that's the worst thing that ever happens to you, you're very, very lucky. Yes, there are people who complain about some of the quote restrictions in Singapore. They have not affected me very much at all. Singapore has, as far as I can see, has just about everything a person would want. You can go to the opera, you can go to the brothel, you can go wherever you want in Singapore. I don't go to brothels, but I'm making the point that Singapore has a very, very a lifestyle. You can do just about anything you want. I have not, my children and my wife and I have not felt constrained at all. And we came here from New York, which is one of the most exciting cities in the whole world, as far as I can see. You can even chew gum here now. You cannot sell gum, but you can chew gum. So that's a step in the right direction. Yes, there's one party, but on the other hand, there's one party. There was one party in Russia, and the Russians didn't do much with it. You know, it was a disaster. There's one party in Mexico. Mexico hasn't done much with it. One party in Mexico. Only one party won an election in the past 75 years in Mexico. But there are more than one party. Singapore works. There are many countries in the world that have one party.
that don't work. Cuba has one party, it's a disaster. The Congo has one party, it's a disaster. So I would think that since Singapore works so well, and by the way, Singapore is opening up more and more, as you probably know, you can go to Speaker's Corner now, you can make movies about politics now. You can write letters to the editor now. I didn't quite understand Singapore. You know, when I first came to Singapore in 1985, I would say, I didn't quite understand Singapore, but in the last couple of years, I've figured it out. What they do here is they take these reasonably young people, 30s and 40s, and they get elected to parliament, but then they have to work their heads off. I mean, they spend hours, days, doing nothing but going to their constituents and finding out what they need and how to make Singapore better. It's an astonishing system. In America, we have congressmen, members of parliament, who spend most of their time trying to get money from other people. In Singapore, you cannot give money to parliamentarians. It's not allowed. So in America, the system is supposed to work that way, but it doesn't work that way. The congressmen, the parliamentarians, provide very little to their constituents, whereas in Singapore, they provide an enormous. You should go, if you haven't been, you should go to one of these sessions. All parliamentarians in Singapore have to be open to the public at least one night a week. You should go. I went one night just to see what it was like. You know, all these people standing around, they go in and they complain about my husband's got a girlfriend, my dent, my teeth are bad, whatever it is. So they go in there, and that's why Singapore works. So far it's been a remarkable situation, and I didn't know I couldn't eat and drink on the MRT. It doesn't bother me that much, and the country is opening up. And compared to all of the other one-party states I know, this is far and away. But Japan, Japan's a one-party state. Just about all of it. You know, Japan's only had one or two-year period that the opposition party won an election in Japan, and that's since 1955. This one works. I don't condone some of the lack of freedom of the press that seems to be here, but it's opening up.
Last question.
Sorry, then I have a story I have to tell.
Go ahead. Hello, my name is Wong from Nanyang Business School.
From where?
From Nanyang Business School.
Yes.
Because I think I'm a bit mature, so although I would like farming, I think I should choose a business course right now because I have the chance to meet great people here. And with what we see every day in the newspaper, I would like to have your opinion on what you think the implications to the policymakers and to the market for this sentence. We are talking about those who steal should be penalized or should be jailed. How do you apply this to the current market? And I actually have a second question from my friend behind me. We would like to know, as a student here, how can we capitalize with what's happening or the role that you are looking at in Malaysia?
Capitalize on what?
The growth in Asia. Realize Asia's full potential. Realize Asia's full potential.
How do you realize Asia's full potential? Right. You want a hot tip. You want to get rich. So do I. And what year were you born in this? Well, you said you were mature. I'm just trying to answer your question.
In the year when you entered the Wall Street.
Ah, right. That's the year my wife was born. She's turning 40 this year. Listen, I love 40-year-old women. I'm not going to be part of them. So don't misunderstand. Listen, a lot of people should be in jail in America right now. The people who ran Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are two major financial institutions, he's only accounting for at least 15 years. They took huge millions of dollars in bonuses. And what they did was worse than what many of the other people who are in jail for. They should definitely be in jail. Lots of people in America should be in jail right now. Unfortunately, I'm afraid they're not going to go to jail because people are so frantic about the economy, they don't have time to think about putting people in jail. The U.S. government is making many mistakes. The policies which they are pursuing during this crisis are making it worse, and are going to continue to make it worse. This is going to turn into the longest recession that we've had, the longest economic period we've had, bad period for probably since the Second World War. And if they keep making it bad and keep making mistakes, it's going to turn into the Depression. I'm not suggesting that it will, but if they keep making mistakes, it will. That's what happened in the 30s, you know. The politicians took a bad situation and made it worse and turned it into the Depression. That could happen again because there's so much government in the system right now. I commend you for coming and getting a business degree. And we'll certainly, I hope, figure out what your passions are and you will learn some skills here, I hope. And then we'll help you develop your passions. And that's the best way for you to explore what's happening in Asia. And that's the way for all of us to explore what's happening in Asia. I moved here because I see a great future in Asia. I mentioned some fields before, Asian tourism, Chinese tourism, water treatment, there are a lot of things going on in Asia. And no matter what happens in America, if America falls off the face of the earth, there's still going to be people here making fortunes. If you're in water treatment in Asia, you don't care if America disappears. You're going to be too busy going to work.
And how about the implications to the policymakers?
The implications? Well, the implications of the policymakers, they keep making mistakes, at least in America and Europe. Now, so far in Singapore and in Asia, they haven't made any mistakes, the policymakers have. And as I, when I said before, that Singapore is going to be the last nation standing, it might be. Because at least so far, the politicians in Singapore have not made mistakes. Most of the Asian politicians have not made mistakes. I wish the Chinese were running the American Central Bank. The Chinese Central Bank is a lot better run than the American Central Bank. China started trying to cool things off about 3 years ago because they could see things were overheating. They've been reasonably successful at it. Now they're starting to loosen up at a time when they should. But they have the reserves, they have the savings, they have the money that they can start loosening up without causing too many problems. So far, Asia's done a much better job with policymakers in Asia than they have in the United States or in Europe. And I hope they continue. As I say, I would like the central bank, the communist central bank in China, to run the capitalist central bank in America. I mean, America's more. You know, it's socialism for the rich in America right now. It's welfare for the rich. They're bailing out the bankers instead of letting them go broke because they're all their friends. No. What's happening in America is going to get worse. The policies are the wrong policies. The policies that they're pursuing have never worked, but they're bailing out their friends. Now, I have to tell you one last story. Thank you, man. Thank you. But I have to tell one last story. Let me get my clicker. I told you all before that the number one dream which people have in the world is to head off around the world. But I want you to know it's not nearly as easy as it looks. So all this fantasy people have, you can read a couple of my books and you'll see it sounds like a lot of fun. But this is the car we were in. That's Pace. Happens to be Indian, but that's not the point. I just want to show you a picture of the car because the story is about travel. Pace and I have been all around the world on the last leg of our trip. We were in California, a city called Palo Alto, to be exact. And a woman came running over to us, a middle-aged woman, and said, "Oh my gosh, this is my dream. You're fulfilling my dream. I've always wanted to drive around the world." And by the way, this happened to us everywhere. India, Africa, didn't matter, Siberia, China, everywhere. People would come running over and say the same thing. But then the lady looked at the car and she said, "Well, that's a two-seater, isn't it?" He said, "Yes." She said, "Every day for 3 years you're in a two-seater, side by side?" He said, "Yes." He said, "Never apart from each other?" He said, "Yes." She said 240,000 kilometers. He was sitting there in a two-seater side by side. He said, "Yes." He said, "My fiance and I set out to drive from the east coast of America to the west coast of America, and we hate each other. And we have never spoken to each other." He said, "He got out halfway, and
I was so happy. I didn't even slow down. I want you to know it's not easy. Anyway, thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for your insights too, and thank you Professor Young for moderating the session. Please be seated on stage. Thank you. At this juncture, I'd like to invite Professor Julian Yeo, Executive Associate Dean, Nanyang Business School, on stage to deliver the vote of thanks. Professor Yeo, please.
Okay. Good evening, Jim, Bernard, Elaine, ladies and gentlemen. It is now my great pleasure and honor, on behalf of Nanyang Business School, NUS Business School, the Action Community for Entrepreneurship, as well as all faculty, guests, and students here who are in the audience, to really extend a very deliver a vote of thanks and great appreciation to Jim for this taking time off from his very busy schedule to be here to deliver a very interesting and insightful speech. This is actually a very timely event, and I think we were very happy that both NUS as well as NTU Business School got together with ACE at this time to invite Jim over, because I think this is a time where there is a great need to know more about what's happening in the world with this current serious global crisis that's going on. And so my take is that the insights that we have learned from Jim are really something that we can really take home with us. Now, what I want to, a couple of things that kind of impressed me as Jim was delivering his speech is that firstly, I think this is really somebody that really has a very balanced work life. He's giving us, he's teaching us that he works hard, he earns his billions of dollars, and at the same time, he also plays very hard. And it's a very balanced work life, and it's a personal life. He shares his personal life instead of just going to the nuts and bolts of finance. He shares his personal life, and in the whole conversation, we do learn a lot more about Jim and his family members. So I think this is a very engaging way to deliver lectures, and we as faculty, as well as if you are coming up to be budding faculty or lecturers, I mean, this is really a very engaging way to deliver your message. The second thing that I think we did learn a lot from Jim is that I know this is a time where all of us are so concerned about where to put our money in, because apparently stocks don't work, bonds don't work, fixed deposits also don't work, all the banks are going bust. And so a lot of people are talking about how about hiding it under your, keeping, withdrawing the money and putting it under your pillow cases. And so I think with Jim's direction as to his insights into the commodities market, I think that is something that is interesting, and I think it's something that's really going back to the very fundamentals, the basic materials, the basic commodities that really help to set develop this whole industry cycle, this whole manufacturing businesses, and so on. And so last but not least, I would just want to comment a little bit on what are the implications for all of us in the aftermath of this crisis, this global crisis. And I think right at the heart of what's going on here, as Jim had already mentioned, is that markets seem to be driven, I'm more of a little bit of a pessimistic type, there seems to be a lot of greed as well as fear that is driving the markets. And why is the greed overwhelming and causing things to happen? Because if this happens once, it happens again, it happens several times, unless we really do something to fundamentally fix the fundamental flaws in the system. And I think one of the ways is probably that has been discussed is really the incentive compensation systems for all of these investment bankers out there. We really need to rethink through how do we really come up with better systems instead of just giving out the bonuses or the compensation right at the start when you complete a deal. How about making sure that it really is a deal that goes through and it is not not fall apart after that, because as a result of all these greed that is in the market right now, is that the systems are failing, and again, the whole market collapses, and this affects the whole, it's a contagious effect. So last but not least, I think I would like again to represent the students and everyone here to extend a note of appreciation. We would like to thank Jim once again for the most interesting and insightful talk. And of course, I would also like to thank all from the NUS Business School, the NTU Business School, as well as the ACE community for putting the act together to organize this session. So thank you, Jim, for a very enjoyable.
Before we present the play, I also would like to add that we are very grateful for you, Jim. And Professor Yao has already said many of the important things that we should learn. I'll just add that. You demonstrate why you're prescient. You are very level-headed, you pay attention to the fundamental, and you attain high clarity of your mind. Based on this, that's why you're successful. Thank you for the demonstration.
Please remain on stage to present a token of appreciation to Mr. Jim Rogers. I would also like to invite Ms. Elin Chu to join us on stage, please. Ms. Chu. Joint organizers once more, NUS Business School, Nanyang Business School, and the Action Community for Entrepreneurship Community for making this event possible. Please remain seated as our VIPs take their leave.